STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
All right, friends, good to be back in the driver's seat here. Greg Kokel, your host on Stand to Reason. I'm listening to my own voice, and it sounds a little bit deeper and richer than usual because I'm still got this creeping crud thing that kept me out of the studio last week. It's a cold flu something or other that really took me out. But I'm able to be back here, kind of drugged up, you know, antihistamines, Tylenol, the whole deal. But I'm glad to be able to chat with you guys. Had a fabulous weekend this last weekend. In fact, I was in San Antonio, Texas area, northeast of San Antonio. I'm not going to try to say the name of the town because I got it wrong every time in the past when I was on the air and I was corrected on it, but now I can't remember the right way to say it. So in any event, I just spent the weekend teaching at a church in San Antonio area, and I got to stay with a family that I got to say was the most fun family I have ever stayed with in all my years doing this stuff. Now I get to stay with great families, and it's a real treat. In fact, I had some time in Sacramento recently with a family, and there are times when instead of putting me up in a hotel, I get to stay with a family, maybe the pastor's family or somebody in the church. And in this case, it was someone in the church who had actually put things together, been part of Stand to Reason for a long time. Most of their kids had grown up listening to the Stand to Reason podcast, and no doubt are listening as I speak right now. Mark and Sue Berry, the parents of that family. And I said fun, like, wow, fun. But I got to qualify that. I don't mean that everything was like party hardy kind of thing. You know, what I mean is that it was just deeply satisfying to be around a bunch of down-to-earth people who were very happy people and happy with each other and happy in the Lord. It's just really, really rich. And it wasn't this kind of highfalutin, fancy schmancy, religious talk, hallelujah, praise the Lord kind of affect. It was just regular folk that, like myself, I guess, that were deeply committed to Christ. And the whole family was that. When I say the whole family, I'm talking seven. And a bunch of them drove down from college, one in third year of med school, another one first year of med school. She flew in. Two others drove down with a whole bunch of their friends from Baylor. And then you had the kids in the house, and I got their names written down somewhere, but it was Grace and Faith and Christian and Luke and, you know, but I can't. I don't have them all right in front of me, so, but they were great folk, and they age from, what, grad school, med school, third year, all the way down to 10 years old, and plus, pretty much all of them are tennis players, and they're serious about it, and they had a tennis court right there in the yard, so when I got there on Thursday evening, I got up Friday morning, when I have events like this a little further away, and I've got an event on Friday night, I don't fly in on Friday, I try to fly in the day before, just in case there's trouble with the airlines, I don't want to miss the event, and so in this case, I flew in on Thursday, and got in pretty late, but got up the next morning, and they said, hey, there's the tennis court. Now, I played competitive tennis for 20 years, but it's been a while, and I've had some problems with my legs and back and whatever, but I just thought, I'm just going to go out and stand at the net and do some volleys. And that's basically what I did for 20 minutes. I got in the backcourt a little bit, but I didn't move much. Fortunately, I was with a family who all knew how to play tennis, and they were good hitters, and they could hit the ball right back to me with some pace, which means it was easy for me to stay on the court for just a little bit. And then we had a reprise in the afternoon. I had a great time with a donor who met me for lunch, and we were able to chat for lunchtime. But then when I came back, I got on the court again. And that was just the beginning of a sweet time with this great family. That I was able to spend the whole time there with them in their home. And I honestly have never seen a group of people who enjoyed each other so much, certainly a family. Now, if some like that, I guess, but this was just fabulous. Now I'm thinking I've got some other friends that really seem to be that great families. I mean, a lot of great families, but this just was sweet for me. New friends for me. And there was not, in the whole weekend, there was not a harsh or angry or unpleasant word the whole time. Now, between them. Now, I don't think they were just on their best behavior, maybe just a little bit. But I think this was pretty natural for them because we were sitting in a restaurant on Sunday after we were all done and having some barbecue down in Texas. And all of the siblings were kind of at one end of this long table, and I was in the middle, and I just pulled out my iPhone, and I just started taking a video of their interactions. It was fabulous. They just really loved one another and enjoyed one another, and it was really touching for me to see that. And to be honest, it was a good example to me, and sometimes experiences like this are like this, where you know in your mind the kind of parent you want to be. You know in your mind, in principle, you have a sense of the kind of family you want to have. But then when you actually see a kind of living, breathing, successful example of that kind of thing, you have a sense of it in a more powerful way than ever before, in that now you're in a better position to reproduce that within your own family. You see the thing incarnate. You see it lived out. And so I know that I went back home, you know, in prayer on the airplane, reflecting, thinking about what I would like to have, how I can have my own family reflect some of this energy and love. And my family is a loving family. There's no question about that. But I knew that there were contributions I could personally make. So this is a self-critique, friends. I'm not saying anything about anybody else in my family. It's a self-critique. How can Papa kind of set a stage the way that Mark and Susan Berry set the stage for their family? How can I do that? You know, there was a conversation that we had at one point, I think Saturday evening, and Mark asked me, the dad asked me about, in our family, do we have family devotions? Now, this is a sore spot for me. I was glad he asked about it. I wasn't offended. But, you know, we don't have that too much. And it's easy for me to rationalize, well, I'm traveling and I'm this, I'm that, and with the other thing, you know. But turns out, you know, Mark is a doctor. He's a surgeon. And his wife is a doctor, too. They're both ophthalmologists, and so he's pretty busy. And the kids are homeschooled, so mom's home quite a bit. But when he comes home, he told me about the kinds of things that they would do, you know. And sometimes they'd go through one thing or another. There's lots of odds and ends you could do. I know that just recently they're all reading through a recent book that was Nabil Qureshi's book on Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, and that's actually a couple years old. So that means he's reading it to his kids now that are all grown, but they're sitting around and it's the evening, and so he's reading a couple chapters a night, and they're all enjoying it together as a family. Better than screen time, right? Better than watching whatever on TV. Here they're enjoying their time together, and it was a good example to me and encouraging. Now, in my family, we haven't done a whole lot of this, but I have, little by little over the last few months, been working my way through Pilgrim's Progress with my girls. So I just decided when I got home that night, and it was, that was late Sunday night. So last night, we had Dane, my son, over. He'd just come back from a trip in the Ukraine. And he's 35 next week, I think, or in 2 weeks or in 3 weeks, something like that. But and he's a paramedic and a nurse, and but the girls really love him. And so he was over, and we had dinner together, and then we sat down by the fire, and I said, let's get out Pilgrim's Progress. And so I was motivated more because of the example set by the Berries, and we sat there in front of the fire, and I read, and it was great because I would pause every paragraph or so, and then we would interact as a family about, especially with my daughters. I'd ask them questions about what was going on and the spiritual significance of it. And in fact, one point I said, notice how Christian is answering this argument from this worldly person trying to justify their worldliness. How is he answering? And my 9-year-old says he's answering from the Bible. Right. He's giving specific verses that answer the charges that were given him. And I went on and finished the evening. Then she fell asleep. We put her to bed. But I noticed after we were done, there was a little notebook paper, a little pad that she had that she'd been writing on, my 9-year-old Eva, and I lifted it up, and there it was. It said, Christian answering challenges from the Bible. And she had it squared off, like emphasized, so she'd gotten it. And she'd written it down, and boy, that was really nice. So we had about half an hour or so reading through Pilgrim's Progress. And what I realized, friends, at that time is if you just take the initiative to get started, well, it wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be. It wasn't highly structured. I could have been reading some other stuff. A week ago, I read something right out of the scripture that I had read earlier on my own. And I thought, well, let's just go over this. And it was only maybe 10 or 15 verses. But I just went over those 10 or 15 verses slowly, and my daughter read some of them. The 9-year-old likes to do the reading when she can. Very eager for that, so I let her read some, and then I asked some questions about it, and they all engaged it. They were interested. And, of course, I'm thinking, well, we ought to do this more often. I saw a movie last week with my girls, one I'd rented from Netflix. It was called How Green Was My Valley, 1936, I think, Best Picture, with Maureen O'Hara at 19 years old and a young 12-year-old Roddy McDowell, about a Welsh family, coal mining family, I don't know, what turn of the century-ish, and the struggles that they went through growing up. It's kind of a coming-of-age movie. It was Best Picture, 1936, I think. Maybe I already mentioned that. But the background, though, it was very spiritual. That is, these were God-fearing people, and it was a moment there when the father, the patriarch, says, "Shall we have a chapter, boys? Shall we have a chapter?" And most of his children are boys, but they're men now. They're all grown up. They're still all working in the coal mine down the road. But they all came reverently to the text, and he read the text there. And there's another scene in there where Roddy McDowell is talking to the pastor that lives down the road. And the pastor says, you know, he's going to make a point. And he just says to Roddy McDowell, you know your scriptures, boy. Like, it's a question, you know your scriptures, boy. And this young lad nods his head, yes. You see, at 12 years old, this lad understood his scriptures, that not every single line, every jot and tittle, but he was so thoroughly acquainted with the Bible because his dad had read chapters and he'd had education there in the church and everything. He was so invested in their lives that he knew his scriptures so that an appeal could be made to the scripture regarding a life issue, and the boy understood where it was coming from. And boy, how different that is today. Even with Christian families, can we go to our 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old, 18-year-old children who grew up in our house and say, you know your scriptures, boy? You know your scriptures, girl? As if, yeah, of course they do know because they've been raised with it, and so you can make that appeal. Well, that's the way I want it to be with my daughters. And I'll tell you, many of you know I have a tremendous amount of help from this fabulous school they go to, which is a Christian school that gives them scripture through and through, Beacon Hill Classical Academy. But even so, I'm dad, and I have my own responsibility for building spirituality into my daughters' lives, for discipling them, for helping them know the scriptures. And because of my own background and knowledge, I can go to the text and read from the text, and I see things jumping out at me all the time. And so it's actually not that hard to say, shall we have a chapter, girls? And then just sit down and go through a chapter and be able to point to a couple of things that are important and significant that I'd like my girls to keep in mind. And then move on. It's feeding. It's food. It's food that gives life to families. And, you know, I pretty much guarantee that if you ask any of the Berry kids, you know your scriptures, boy. They'd be able to step up, and with a lot more than just scriptures, too. So what an encouragement it was to be with them. The weekend was a Francis Schaeffer conference. Francis Schaeffer, who wrote the books God Who Is There, He Is There and He Is Not Silent, and Escape from Reason. Back in the 60s and 70s, I was deeply influenced by him when I first became a Christian, and he died mid-80s, but I had a chance to meet him at La Brie Fellowship in Huemo, Switzerland, where he had a little cluster of chalets and where he taught students. I wasn't part of the school proper, but I did visit there in 1976. And as I look back and I explained to the group that night when I was teaching, I look back and see how deeply and profoundly my own life has been influenced by Francis Schaeffer. I often think about this, and I don't, and I hope it doesn't seem self-aggrandizing, but I'd like to be able to have a sense that there was a contribution that I made to other people's lives, something along the lines of the contribution that Francis Schaeffer has made in mine. That is, there are pieces or tidbits or strong things that are left behind that informed my whole project ultimately as a growing and a thinking Christian, the idea that Christianity is true truth, for example. It's true truth. It's not just relativistic truth. It's the real McCoy, okay? And now I look at the book, The Story of Reality. I also got from Francis Schaeffer the idea that reality is an ally to us as followers of Christ, since Christianity is the best explanation for the way things are. And we don't have to be afraid of reality. The person who has to be afraid of reality is the one who denies it. And anyone who follows a foreign worldview, different from what Jesus of Nazareth understood the world to be like, is following a worldview that at some point has got to deny reality. Christianity doesn't have to do that. We have an ally in reality, and we could watch closely to people when people bump into reality. Schaeffer called it a point of tension, and those can be used. And I talk about in the Tactics book, chapter there on taking the roof off. That's right out of Francis Schaeffer. And then the third thing, the first being the true truth concept, the second one being ally, reality is our ally, and the third one is the importance of pre-evangelism, the fact that culture has changed so much, and so much more, 35 years since Francis Schaeffer left the scene, it has even changed that much and more, and therefore all the more need for a sensitivity to pre-evangelism, what I like to just simply call gardening. And that allowed me, when I talked about that on Friday night, to segue right into the Colombo tactic. So you can see at all those points, my life deeply influenced by these foundational concepts that I first got from Francis Schaeffer, and now they're just part of the warp and woof of my Christian life and influence what I pass on to you. And I, by God's grace, will be passing on those things that stick with you over the long haul and serve you well. And what doesn't serve you well, you can just forget those things, okay? I hope they just go right out of your mind. Anyway, that was my great weekend, and I'm going to be gone again next weekend, but I've got time to be with you here today, and I'm feeling physically up to it, and so glad to be able to take your calls, which I'll do in just a few moments on Stand to Reason. I have been working on one of the most important projects of my life for over a decade now, and it's finally come to press. It's called The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Now, The Story of Reality is a kind of a wide-angle view of the Christian story. It's a big-picture description of the meaning of the drama of human history. And it's meant to cover the basics of Christianity from a worldview perspective, in a voice that's really conversational, not religious. It's kind of a mere Christianity for a new generation, if that comparison doesn't seem too bold. Now, I tell the story using five words that capture the meaning of all of human history from its beginning to its end: God, man, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. The narrative, it's infused with what I call a kind of soft apologetics, that is, thoughtful reflections that are not argumentative, but rather are friendly appeals to common sense notions we're all aware of that point to the truthfulness of the Christian story. I think you'll find The Story of Reality to be, as Lee Strobel put it, a beautifully crafted description of the Christian worldview written in an accessible, winsome, and well-reasoned manner.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Greg Kokel, back at you here on Stand to Reason. And listen, I want to invite you to a party. It is a book release party. Yes, The Story of Reality book release party. And it's coming up February 11th, Saturday morning, Orange County, 9:30 in the morning. It's kind of like a brunch type thing. We'll have a light breakfast and coffee and stuff like that. We got a bunch of fun things planned. It's a chance to meet with you guys and hang out a little bit, meet you face to face. If you're in Southern California, within striking distance, you can drive down. Actually, we've done things like this before. We even have people fly in for it, but I don't know that that's going to happen. But it would be nice to meet you face-to-face. I'll be talking a little bit about the book. Some of the fellows who have endorsed the book will be there also making statements. Michael Horton will be there with the White Horse Inn. Dr. Craig Hazen from Biola Apologetics Program will be there making comments. And we're also going to be filming, or I should say recording, an episode or so of STR Ask, and the questions are actually going to come from the audience, as I understand it. So you'll be there, and you'll be able to submit your questions, and then you'll see Melinda and I kind of bantering together as we do, and delivering the show, which will be recorded and distributed as usual. But you can be there for that. In order to do that, that would be Saturday, February 11th, 9:30 a.m. You need to RSVP. It's in Orange County. It's right off the 405, South Orange County. But you need to RSVP, and here's who you RSVP to. Our wonderful development person, Ocean, is her name, just like Atlantic or Pacific, if you will. Ocean at str.org, str.org. Ocean at str.org. Easy. So, hope you can make it. My personal invitation to you. There'll be a couple other things going on, but I think you'll enjoy it. Saturday, February 11th, 9:30 a.m. in Orange County. RSVP at ocean@str.org. Okay, time to go to the phone calls. And we got first on board from Lancaster, California, Lincoln. I get that right?
Yes, sir.
Hello, Lincoln.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I was wondering, how was Lucifer able to sin in heaven?
Okay, I'm not sure what why would you think he wouldn't be able to sin in heaven? Let me put it this way.
Well, when Lucifer was up in heaven, yeah. he considered himself higher to be equal with God.
No, that's right. I know about that. But you're asking me, how was it, in a certain sense, possible for him to sin in heaven, which makes it sound like you think it's odd or strange that he would be able to sin in heaven. And that's what I'm asking about. Is that what you think? That it would be unusual for him to sin in heaven?
I did not think anyone was able to sin in heaven.
Well, when we talk about not sinning in heaven, we're talking about what happens with regenerate humankind when they go to the final state of things, okay? And in that particular circumstance, God is going to make it so that we will not be able to sin. That's my conviction and the conviction of most, because there'll be no sin in heaven, and there are different ways that people have construed how that could take place. I think it means that God is going to change our nature so that we are immutably holy and we always do good, but whatever, I think that's going to be the case. But that's not the same set of circumstances that Lucifer faced in the beginning. In the beginning, when God created the angelic realm, and this seems like, it's hard to tell all the timing when all this happened, you know, but whenever it was, we know that by Genesis 3, we have a fallen angel, Satan. He's the tempter. He's the serpent. So when God created the angelic realm, they were not fallen, and they were in God's presence, and they were around God, but they were not the kinds of creatures that could never sin. That's the way we'll be as a result of the new birth and the resurrection. We will be transformed so that we will be like him, one text says. And so that's a future circumstance, and I could confidently say we will not be able to sin in heaven, but it's not because we're in heaven. It's not because we're in the presence of God, not on my take. It's because of the change that has taken, God has done in us, the work God has done in us that keeps us from sinning. But before that, it certainly was possible for Satan to sin just like Adam sinned. You see, Satan and Adam were both created morally pure. That is, they had no moral flaw in them, but they did have the freedom to disobey. And the freedom to disobey is not a flaw. It just makes a flaw possible. And in fact, this is what Satan did, Lucifer did, his name before he fell, Shining One, Hillel. And if the passage in the Old Testament about the king of Tyre is indeed about him, we get the picture of that he exalted himself above the Most High, and he had pride in his heart, and he rebelled. He wanted to be as God, and that created a big problem, obviously, and he fell. So Satan, or rather Lucifer, like Adam, was made morally perfect, but with the freedom to fall, and fall he did, just as Adam did. And so consequently, they're in a fallen state now. There is no plan of salvation for angels, none. But there is a plan of salvation, a rescue plan for human beings, which kind of underscores that God doesn't owe anybody a pardon. I mean, if there's rebellion against him, he has no obligation to give forgiveness or offer a pardon. That's why pardon is called a grace. But he does offer it to us, and he makes it possible because of the rescue plan, God becoming a man and doing something for us that can rescue us and change us and secure heaven for us and secure a glorious resurrection for us. So I think the key here, Lincoln, is that the issue is not that you can't sin in heaven, so anybody in heaven can't sin. The issue is when we go to heaven, we will be the kinds of beings, having been transformed by the resurrection, that will not be capable of sinning. At least that's my view. Some people's, everybody that I've heard of regarding this issue, I mean, it's pretty standard, there will not be any sin in heaven. Some think there won't be sin because we will be changed into morally perfect creatures. That's my view. Some say we could, in principle, sin, but we won't because we know how bad it was, so we'll never be tempted to do it. And that's another view. I actually think that's William Lane Craig's view. We do have the freedom to sin, but we won't sin. And so heaven will remain a perfect place. In either case, though, it is not being in heaven that makes sin impossible. It is being the kinds of beings we will be when we're in heaven, that makes sense, that will make heaven a place that is safe from sin. Does that make sense to you? Lincoln? Are you still there? Did we lose Lincoln? Lincoln, I've been thinking.
Oh, hey. Yeah. Sorry, my mom just walked in.
Your mom walked in so you couldn't talk? Is that it?
Oh, yeah, I had to tell her something.
Oh, I see. So you put me on mute. All right. So let me ask you, does that explanation make sense to you?
Yes, sir, it makes sense.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your call.
All right. Thank you for the answer.
Yes, you're very welcome. You know, I understand Lincoln called in last week when I wasn't here, and I think, was Brett in for me? Who was in for me? Yeah, Brett. And by the way, thank you, Brett, for sitting in for me. I appreciate that. Kind of short notice, too. And it's great to have a cadre of people you can count on to do that kind of thing. And but what it shows is that if you don't get in one week, you might get in the next one. Just come back and keep coming back to the trough, so to speak, and you'll get your feeding if you're persistent. Okay, let's go to Mike in Fort Worth, Texas. I was just in your great state a couple days ago, Mike.
Yeah, you were. Sorry we missed it.
Yeah,
Fort Worth. We weren't able to come down and see you.
Fort Worth is up by Dallas, right? It's DFW,
yes,
right?
It is.
Dallas, Fort Worth. Okay.
Right.
So, I will be in Dallas. When will I be in Dallas? Sometime next year. A couple of times, I think. Yeah, keep track of our schedule. I'll be there in October for sure. Rethink.
Oh, for the rethink, right?
Hmm. Yeah, wait, let me just see.
Okay.
Oh, to the spring. Okay, so I won't be. Oh, I see. Okay, so Rethink Dallas is going to be moved a couple of months forward into the spring to avoid high school football. We ran into that problem last year a little bit. We still had 700 and some, almost 800 people. But anyway, I think I got something scheduled sometime this year. Just keep your eyes on the scoreboard, so to speak, and on our website, and maybe we'll be able to connect. So what's on your mind, Mike?
Well, at the inauguration last Friday, one of the people that stood up and either offered a prayer or read scripture brought something from Matthew, the Beatitudes, Matthew 5, verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't get past the word justice because I had already always memorized it as righteousness.
That's right.
And subsequently, I've been told that the Greek root word for justice and righteousness are the same,
uh-huh.
But I just do not see justice and righteousness as being synonymous.
Yeah.
So I am just stymied.
Right. Well, some words have multiple meanings. In fact, most words have multiple meanings, and that's the case here. They're not univocal, they're equivocal, and the context is what determines how one translates. Now, I don't know anything about the discussion back and forth, or even if there is one, of whether verse 6 ought to be translated righteousness or justice. I don't know that. All the times that I've read the text, and I have a New American Standard here, and mine says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Okay? And I guess I've gone over this passage a number of times, and I think that there's a trend here. You know, I'm not surprised that somebody reads hunger and thirst for justice, because I think what they're thinking is about something that is foreign to the biblical record. They're thinking social justice. And as one friend put it, whenever you add an adjective to the word justice, you corrupt it. justice ought to be fine just the way it is, you know, without racial justice or social justice or ethnic justice or whatever you want to put in front of it. Justice is justice and applies equally wherever it applies appropriately, okay? And social justice has just become kind of a euphemism for socialism, it seems to me. And maybe the person who's quoting this passage was trying to insinuate that idea into this political enterprise here. So,
well, I think it's from the new, the quote was quoting from the New Living Translation.
Well, all right. Well, the New Living Translation is a free translation. That is, it's a it is a paraphrase, and paraphrases are just not the kinds of things that you can count on to be precise and accurate. But I want to look at something else here. You know what our rule is with Bible passages, right?
Never study a verse by itself.
There you go. That's another way of putting it. Never read a Bible verses my way, but you got it just right. So the Sermon on the Mount, here's the way Jesus starts. He opened his mouth, began to teach them. And by the way, it starts out by he's teaching his disciples. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying, blessed are the, and this is where a lot of people get it wrong. It says poor here, but it doesn't stop there. It tells what kind of poor. It doesn't say poor in money. It says poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. That is, those who acknowledge their spiritual poverty. Okay? Those people who realize that they are lost in themselves. Jesus said, I came to seek and to save that which was lost. I came to give my life for sinners, to give my life a ransom for many. So he starts out here in the very beginning of his ministry with the first great discourse of his ministry, the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, if you understand that you are poor in spirit, like a lot of people that was there did not, a lot of the religious leaders, they didn't get it. They thought they were rich in spirit. They don't need Jesus. They're okay. They, like the Pharisees standing in the front of the synagogue saying, look how great I am. He said, no, by contrast, those who are poor in spirit, what do the poor in spirit get? They get heaven. Blessed are the poor in spirit, those who recognize their spiritual poverty, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn. Now, do you think Jesus, Mike, do you think Jesus was talking about anybody who's just crying?
Well, probably. Well, no. It'd just be mourning over sin, like the...
I think you're right.
Like the guy at the... forgive me.
Yes, that's what I think so, too. It's not just mourning. It's not like anybody who cries, they're going to be comforted by God. No, it's the context. There's a flow here. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom. Blessed are those who mourn. Mourn over what? Mourn over their spiritual poverty, I think. How do you know that? It's the verse right before it. For they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the kingdom. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for... Well, see, justice or righteousness, righteousness fits pretty good, it seems to me. If you hunger and thirst for righteousness, they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, this is what happens to those people who have entered into what comes just before. All of those who mourn spiritually because of their spiritual poverty, and they are made gentle and hunger for righteousness, they will be satisfied, pure in heart, but they will be persecuted. So there's nothing, I don't see this passage about social justice, frankly. And that's why I'm not compelled to think of the word translated righteousness as should be a translated justice. And I think actually the rest of the passage up until the end of chapter 5 is about the demands of the law that he's putting squarely on the shoulders of those who do not think they are poor in spirit. And he ends for those people with this statement, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Good luck. So, yeah, I didn't know about that. I didn't know about that during the...
So if the Greek word, the root Greek word for justice and righteousness is the same, there has to be some connection, I would think.
No, not necessarily. We have all kinds of words that have of totally different kinds of meanings, even though they're from the same word. I wish I could think of one right off the top of my head. But you look in the dictionary, you look up any word, and you'll see this word goes in all kinds of different directions. And sometimes one of the iterations or the meanings of that word is completely different from what that word actually means. Look at the word quick. Quick, okay? The word quick means maybe moving fast or could mean alive. Like the quick and the dead. Now, we don't use the word in that way so much anymore. It's a little archaic usage, but it just means alive. There may be a connection. I'm just simply saying it ain't necessarily so.
Okay. Do you suppose that justice could be God's justice?
Could be. It could be. Now, those who are hungering, thirsting for justice, though, I mean, if it's God's justice... Gee, that means they're going to be the subjects of God's justice, too. You know what I'm saying? Apart from the mercy of God. So even if we call it justice as the right word to be translated here, it's still in this broader context of the broken and contrite sinner before God. Picture that we get out of Psalm 51, and we see that being characterized here as well. The gentle, inheriting the earth, those who mourn for righteousness, those who are poor in spirit. I think the first verse is the one that really sets the tone. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom. Now, some people say, blessed are the poor. That's it.
Oh, well, no.
Yeah, and so then they're going on, well, how does that work? That isn't what Jesus had in mind. Now, when it says that he come to get released to the captives and he came for the poor... I think even in that passage, he's talking about poor in spirit, not those who don't have much cash. Okay?
Okay. So is it would it be accurate to summarize your position that erasing the word righteous and putting in justice does harm to the verse?
Well, I guess it depends. It may. It depends what the person who does that is trying to accomplish. And my suspicion, and I could be totally mistaken, I'm just getting all this secondhand from you, but if somebody's reading out the verse, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, my suspicion is what they're saying is justice is not being done in this country. Well, who is the ones that's suffering for lack of justice? And, well, I could tell you in terms of the cultural ethos right now, it is those who, quote-unquote, the poor, but, of course, many of the people who are poor in our country, so-called poor, are wildly rich compared to everybody else in the world. So it might be the poor, and it might be the disenfranchised gays, for example, or the gender-confused, or something like that. I mean, my suspicion is this was a leftist cause, and this is all class, race, gender kind of warfare. And
it was done by the woman the second time people came up, White Cain, Paula White Cain, that apparently has a big church down in Orlando, Florida. And it was just, I'm quoted from that.
Yeah, well, I don't know anything about the source. All I'm going by is what you said. And it might be that the citation by that person was completely innocent and that you could say hunger and thirst for righteousness or justice, either one, and they will be satisfied. But I'm just wondering, why would they cite that one? Why didn't they cite blessed are the peacemakers? Why wouldn't they say, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness?
Now, okay, so that the person quoting from the New Living Translation may well have a point to make, i.e. the social justice part of the Beatitudes, which isn't there, but that would be the motivation. Is that an accurate read on what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is they definitely would have a point to make, okay? That's why they're reading anything out loud, because they're trying to make a point. And secondly, it strikes me that my first impulse was that they're trying to make a point about so-called social justice. But again, I don't know the background. I know the person, and I'm just responding based on what you told me. But I see there's a lot of other things they might have mentioned. If they're going to quote from the Sermon on the Mount, why not? And let's just say they're from a very solid church of people who love Christ and are followers of Christ. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. There is a whole lot more persecution going on now for the sake of righteousness than any kind of persecution that is happening because of unrighteousness.
Okay.
It just seems to me that's the way it is right now. And so, consequently, I mean, what are the things that you have to be afraid of saying on campus? That you're gay, or that you're a Christian follower of Christ. I mean, that's all. The only question I need to ask, right? Or anywhere for that matter. Except for maybe in a church, but you never know now, even in a church, what people are going to actually believe about that. So you can't count on that. But anyway, I could be completely mistaken. But because I didn't see it, I don't know who the person was, but just from what you've told me, that's my suspicion.
Okay. Right?
Okay, Mike?
It's good to hear your voice again. Thanks.
Hey, that's sweet. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now. All right, let's take a quick break and back with more of Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what Scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5x11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Well, we've got some fun things coming up here in the next few weeks. This weekend, coming up on the 29th, I'll be at the West Jackson Baptist Church in Jackson, Tennessee. And then the first weekend of February, the 4th and the 5th, I'll be in Vancouver, Canada at Parksville Fellowship Baptist Church, Parksville, B.C. And then following that on Wednesday night, it's the 15th of February. I'll be at Living Oaks Community Church in Newberry Park, California. So And I'll be doing the story of reality that night. It's part of their apologetics conference. Mary Jo Sharp will be there tomorrow night. And I don't know who's the following week. They got a great lineup, though, and we do this every year. Super community church doing a fabulous apologetics conference, a different speaker every Wednesday night for about 6 or 7 weeks. So I'll be doing that. And just anticipating here a little bit, I don't have my notes in front of me, but towards the end of February, I'm actually going to be at State of Hawaii, and I have never gone to the State of Hawaii as a speaker for Stand to Reason. I don't think I have ever. We had one thing that got canceled once, and I visited there in 19. Well, yeah, I know I visited in 20, let's see, right after I got married and did some work with Hope Chapel there. In any event, this is an unusual, opportunity. So I'm going to be at the University of Hawaii for a presentation, and then that last weekend of February, I will be at a church there in Oahu, and then I'll be at an event on Sunday night in Maui, and then a Monday night in Maui. So I'll have a number of things there in the islands that if you're there, you may want to be thinking about. You can go to our website, str.org/training/events, and get all the details for not just my schedule, but for Brett Allen's and Tim's at the same time. And don't forget, April 21st through 22nd, Rethink Alabama. We'll be at the Briarwood Presbyterian Church in Birmingham, and you can still get early bird prices, $25. Just go to rethinkapologetics.com. All right. Now, last week, see, a little more than a week ago, picked up Dane, my son, from the airport. He was in the Ukraine. And as we were driving back, he was there with a medical team, and one of the doctors he works with was with him. And he started asking me about the book, Dane did, because I know he wanted me to talk a little bit about spiritual things with his doctor friend who did know the Lord, as far as we know. And so I talked a little bit about it with him, and then you know, explain the nature of the book and everything in response to Dane's question and trying to lay a foundation and see if I'd get a rise or a question, and nothing happened, okay? And so I just asked him, have you worked out any of these details for yourself? Since I had talked about the spiritual saga, information, whatever, about the story of reality, basically what it was about, it's Christianity, okay, have you worked out any of these details for yourself? And his response was essentially, well, I'm kind of a spiritual person, but I'm not actually religious. And you've heard that, I'm sure, many times before. And I asked him immediately, well, what's the distinction? What's the difference between spiritual and religious? And he offered some thoughts that weren't really, I don't think, very well thought through, but it's okay. And then the conversation just kind of faded out. Now, you know what Dane was wanting to do and what I was wanting to do, and that is we wanted to engage this person in an intelligent way on things that really matter, the spiritual things, and just see if we could put a stone in his shoe or not and see what happens. But this was a fairly short conversation that ended up going nowhere. So I think, though, there are a few takeaways that you can grab onto, sink your teeth into from this short conversation. And here's the first thing. Sometimes people ask me, how do you transition in your conversation that's just talking about general stuff into spiritual things? And I'll just say sometimes there's nothing special. Maybe it's you just ask, all right? Have you resolved these questions for yourself is what I said, even though we were kind of into a spiritual discussion at the time. Or we say, have you done any thinking about blah, blah, spiritual things? Or what's your own background on this? If you had touched a little bit on some spiritual things, let the other person speak. What do you think happens after you die is a question that I've heard people ask and has been productive for them. The point I'm making is you don't have to be fancy, you don't have to be clever, you don't have to have just the right line. All you have to do is just show an interest in their spiritual point of view by asking a generalized question to see if they want to answer. And if they don't want to answer, fine. If they do, all right, great. Give them room. Don't give them pressure. whatever they say, clarify. Ask a question like I did to get a clarification. That's Columbo number one. What do you mean by that? Okay, pretty straightforward. Now, the second thing that is a little bit of a takeaway from this conversation for me, the first being that, you know, how do you get into these conversations? Sometimes you just throw it out and ask and see what they say. The second thing, though, is that sometimes these conversations don't go very far, at least initially. It just doesn't seem like much is happening. My recommendation is just follow your game plan, your Columbo game plan. Ask questions. Listen to everything. Ask some more questions. Let them talk. That's it. In my case, I knew there was an opportunity for follow-up because Dane worked with the guy, and I actually gave him a copy of the story of reality. I signed it off to him and handed it to him. I had one in the car. So I knew there was an opportunity for things to follow through, and I was willing to just let that take its natural course if it were. There was one other thing that I took back from this, and this was an observation my wife made afterwards. And in the book, I talk about the concept of the big picture of reality in pieces, puzzle pieces, you know. And it turns out some people have just the puzzle pieces. They don't have the big picture. That's a concept I develop in the book. But I realize when somebody says, I'm spiritual but not religious, and this was my wife's contribution, it's because they have their religious viewpoint in a bunch of pieces. Religions are coherent, constructed pieces of the puzzle into a coherent whole, I guess is a way of putting it. And this he had not done, apparently, but he still had spiritual bits and pieces. Being spiritual leaves things vague. You can pick and choose what you like. You have the puzzle pieces in a pile, as it were. So anyway, I guess the long and short of it is that when you get in these kinds of conversations with people, some go someplace and some don't go anywhere. It's all right. And some just go a little bit and then you don't know if it's going to get picked up later, which was kind of, I think, the way this conversation went. Didn't last very long. And when it died a natural death, I wasn't eager to push forward and keep pressing. Since the person I was talking to was not showing a lot of interest, don't bruise the fruit, just let it go, is my view. But don't be afraid to at least get started, all right? Ask questions. See where it goes or where it doesn't go, whatever. Just be relaxed and go into the circumstance as a student. See what the other person has to say. See what they believe, if anything. The whole goal of the first step of the game plan is just to gather information. And once you gather information, you'll have an idea of where you might want to go after that. Just a thought for you. That's all the time we have for this hour, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.
Been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.